Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, with the business in crisis and Trump threatening to sue, we look at the economics of the BBC. Cruises. Have you ever been on one? We look at the eye-watering amounts of business they do on and off the water. Plus this. This Tuesday was Singles Day, and we hear all about the Chinese-inspired retail day that has overtaken Black Friday. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my explainer this week, I wanted to pick up on a term that is used many times in the Delivering Homes, Building Communities report. Now, specifically, the report refers to over 9 billion euro of capital funding will be available for housing in 2026 alone. So let me just explain the difference between current and capital expenditure. Right, just think about your own household, right? So the money you spend on grocery shopping is day-to-day spending, so that's current. But if you were to put an extension onto your house, well, that's capital, as the life of the thing you're spending money on is going to last longer than, well, we'll say a year at least. And similarly then, from the point of view of the economy, the money spent on paying for homeless accommodation, for example, would be current spending, whereas building houses and the infrastructure supporting it would be capital. So, as you're listening to the commentary about the report, or indeed any sort of government expenditure, now you know the difference between capital and current. Now, you'd be familiar with Black Friday and Prime Day, but one discount day event you may not have heard of is Singles Day, which officially takes place every November 11th, but mainly in Asia. I'm joined now by money expert and author Kel Gallivan to tell us more about Singles Day and whether we might see the day grow in Ireland. So, Kel, on 11th of November 2009... Alibaba offered 50% discounts and free shipping across a limited selection of 27 brands, encouraging single people to treat themselves. And by midnight, the platform had roughly six times a normal day's revenue. How has this grown into the biggest revenue day in the world?
Yeah, you're right, Susan. Like, Singles Day 11/11 is the biggest online and retail sales day in the world. It eclipses Black Friday, it eclipses Cyber Monday, it eclipses Amazon Prime Day even, it eclipses everything. But actually where it came from, I think, is really interesting. It started off in 1993, and there was four male students in the Nanjing University in China, and they were just, we're not doing Valentine's. You know, we are going to celebrate our singledom, and we're going to buy ourselves presents, and we're going to have a party. And they picked 11/11, so because it was like four single guys, to do this. And it was originally called Bachelor's Day.
Oh,
yes.
All right.
Originally, kind of guys were doing this to celebrate their independence and their bachelordom. But then it grew a bit over China. And that was that over the 90s and early 2000s. And that's when Alibaba stepped in and went, let's just harness the living daylights out of this. And that's what's happened. And it has grown from four guys going, I'm not doing Valentine's, to now the world's biggest online and retail sales.
And you mentioned earlier on that it has eclipsed Prime Day, Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Can you give us a sense of the scale of what sort of eclipsing that it's done?
In one day, $195 billion is spent. So that, if my calculations are correct, it's approximately 168 billion euro in one day.
It's amazing. Like, that isn't far off the Irish GDP. Like, spot the economist here now. But that's the point. So the volume of economic activity that happens in Ireland in a year happens in a day around the world by simply people saying, you know what, I'm just going to treat me.
Yeah, and the whole idea now, it's for men and women now. It started off for just guys, and now it's just all singles that are doing it. And the whole idea is, it's kind of, it's not necessarily a full-on kickback from Valentine's, but it's more, I'm going to treat myself. I'm going to show my independence. I'm worth it. Because I think often, and one of the reasons maybe it has kind of taken a kind of legs to it, is that a lot of single people, they tend to be kind of, you know, always the, there's a supplement to being single, or they're always buying gifts for people getting married, or all this kind of thing, and Valentine's. So they're inadvertently sometimes left out of some of the bigger type of festivals. And this was a way of going, I'm going to celebrate myself. And that's how it's grown. And it's moving very fast across Asia, Southeast Asia, Australia, Malaysia, and it's coming into Europe big time now. So I would guess in the next year or two, it's going to be a very normal thing, just like Black Friday is.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wonder, and I'd love to hear from our listeners. Please email us in at takingstock@newstalk.com. If you are in retail, what your experience of this has been, or whether you're now listening to Kel saying, actually, I need to get on top of this. And I do also want to ask you about this. You mentioned the word festival, whereas I mentioned the word day. So this has really stretched, hasn't it, over like over much more than a day. When I see the two big players here, JD and Alibaba's Tmall, they open pre-sales in October where shoppers can pay a small deposit to reserve a deal and pay off the balance on Double 11, as they call it. So how has the day, in inverted commas, evolved into a festival?
Well, if you think about it, if you're buying stuff online, you might want to wait till the actual day. And if you're a good, if you're a good company and a good business person, you're thinking, well, how can I facilitate it to make it easier for people? How can I sell more stuff? Because ultimately, these are for-profit businesses, and it's on them to actually build up profit. And if you can broaden it past one day, then you're going to open up the playing field to have people spending more. And if you think about it, Black Friday isn't even Black Friday anymore. It's nearly like Black Friday month. Mm-hmm. And they actually call it Black Friday month, some of the places. And you can see the sales coming in from the end of kind of October onwards. And already we're awash with Black Friday. And this is just another similar thing.
And is it just shopping, or has the experience changed?
But I think anybody who... it doesn't have to be a gift. If you're going to treat yourself, it doesn't have to be a physical thing. It could be any number of things.
It could be an experience.
Yeah, so it could be an online experience. It could be an in-store experience. It could be a spa experience. Whatever it is, like, if you're able to buy it and treat yourself with it, then it kind of falls under the category of Singles Day.
It's funny because as I'm listening to you, it sounds more L'Oreal, because you're worth it, as distinct to Alibaba. But I also wanted to ask you as well about, when we look at Chinese retail, like, what's the role of culls, or the key opinion leaders, on the Chinese platforms like Taobao Live or Douyin, the Chinese TikTok type of platforms? Is the role of influencers particularly prevalent in China or across Singles Day?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's not even kind of tied to Singles Day. Influencers are huge because they actually spread the word of A, the existence of it, and B, how much, you know, you could buy or treat yourself with, or things you didn't even want before suddenly you feel like you're wanting them. And that's a very much a double-edged sword for anybody listening, because if you have an influencer you follow and you really like them, and you like what they're doing, and you kind of like their lifestyle, and you kind of want to be like them, well, you're going to be more inclined to buy the things that they're talking about and letting you know about. And if they're buying stuff for Singles Day and it's a particular thing, you go, well, maybe I'll be more like them. Whether you're consciously thinking of it or not, because a lot of the influencer stuff is buying into a lifestyle. You're buying into, maybe I'll be a bit more like them if I get this thing and bring this thing into my life. So it's huge.
And do you see, just to move the conversation a bit more broadly, globally, do you see the role of influencers changing? Because influencers have been here for a while. Do you see that changing in terms of the trends? Is it specifically for a younger demographic, or is it specifically on social media?
I don't know. Like, there are a lot of influencers that are moving off their immediate platforms into maybe just broader roles, being ambassadors for things and doing talks and stuff like that. I do think it doesn't matter what age you are, there's going to be people that you're going to be looking at. Like, back in what my youth, you know, 80s, 90s, where you had MTV and you had actors, you were looking at those. They were a bit more distant. Whereas now influencers, there's more of them, but you're still going to have people you like, whatever age they are, that you're going to want to follow or know what's going on in their lives. And as such, they're going to have an influence on what you do and how they choose to go with that. I don't know if we could tell yet or not.
Of course. And also, I think the point there that you make is the proximity to influencers, because they appear in your feed, or because they can be very vulnerable at certain moments. It's certainly not the distance of MTV. You're right there for sure. Can I also ask as well about gamification? Because that's something China does really well. When I was looking into how Singles Day actually manifests itself, there's a lot of apps now that they have where the different coupons, and when I say different coupons, I mean stacking coupons. This is a professional sport. They've augmented reality, catch the coupon, and they've other ways of, and this is a term I learned, shopper entertainment. Have you? Can you give us some insight into that? Because this seems to be quite elaborate.
Yes, and it's getting so sophisticated. Some of the most intelligent people work in sales and marketing. And when you walk into a store, marketing has gone from, you know, like your sight and sound, where you can kind of look at something maybe in a store or on TV or the jingle that goes with it. That was back in the before times, but now it's full on holistic. It's like sight, taste, sound, touch, feel. It's everything in store. But you can't always get that online. You can't get scent online. You can't get taste necessarily online. So they have to use other things. And us as humans, like we're amazingly wired, but there are things like we have get these dopamine hits. So when you win, for want of a better phrase, you know, that gamification, you go, oh, I got an extra coupon or I got an extra deal. We feel not just that dopamine hit, but then we also feel this thing called self-efficacy, which is basically we feel better about ourselves because we're more savvy shoppers. And that feeds into who we are. And there's another big part of that between the dopamine, the self-efficacy. There's also a thing called loss aversion. And we hate to lose things. We hate losing. We hate losing money. We hate losing deals. We hate losing all those things.
FOMO, fear of missing out.
Exactly. So if you have something saying, oh, there's only three left, or, you know, the sale's nearly over, you're going to want to go, oh, actually, I think I better get that quick before it's gone. Because that loss aversion is huge. So online harnesses that massively, those three things, to have us clicking before we even know it, even if we didn't want whatever it was 5 minutes beforehand, suddenly it's the only thing we can focus on.
Do you know what I found interesting in my research about this as well is how it has become part of the culture to ask, what are you getting for Singles Day? Not are you going to do something for Singles Day, but what are you getting? Almost as if, number one, the singles bit seems to be less so, more about treating oneself, even if one is treating oneself in a relationship anyway. I think it's an intriguing evolvement culturally about how something started off with celebrating freedom of being a bachelor. They were in college, Kel. Like, I mean, like they hadn't a lot to celebrate at that stage if they were celebrating bachelorism. And then to move on to, as you say, the inadvertent sense of the single supplement. And now simply treating oneself and then the gamification of all of what you're saying. It's interesting about how this has evolved over time.
Yes, and I can't, from my own opinion, I can't say it's all good.
Okay.
Because, the advance of technology is amazing. The amount of things we can get that we never had access before would blow your mind. But that constantly puts pressure on people to go, well, I need to be spending more. I need to get the thing that's on trend. I need to keep up with my peers. I need to keep up with the influence. I need to keep up. And that is a really stressful place to be. And we often end up spending a lot more than we're comfortable with, that we want to, just to try and keep up with the Joneses. So I think it is a double-edged sword that way. And another big thing that I want to be really conscious of as well, because you said it so well, what are you getting for it? It's like the assumption is there. But what are you getting for Black Friday then? What are you getting for Cyber Monday? What are you getting for the pre-Christmas sales, the post-Christmas sales, the January sales, the Valentine sales, the Easter sales, the summer sales, the back to school?
Wow.
But I can keep going on. It's we only have 365 days in the year. And sometimes I wonder, are we going to run out of days? Is there any like non-buy me days out there? So while I find it fascinating and absolutely amazing what the world is capable of and how we can get all these things, if somebody is trying to manage their money better, it is okay to have a day or one of those bigger days or single days where you don't buy anything. Mm-hmm. And that could actually be the treat to yourself to give you a day off.
There you go. Kel is giving you permission, certainly, to do that. I found interesting as well, just picking up on that point about the pressure. I was trying to find the number that you quoted to us earlier on about the $195 billion. And I was looking around for how much did Singles Day 2025 deliver? And I couldn't find it. And that was because, one of the reasons was, in 2021, JD and Alibaba reported $139 billion over the festival, and they're the two key brands. But it stopped reporting its figures since then, and partly due to the use of big screens across the internet highlighting how much was being spent in real time. But then this was turning into turnover worshipping, they were saying. So instead, since there is such a focus on how much was being spent, and because people like me were asking that question, it was turning into simply a flurry of expenditure as opposed to questioning that. Do you think, do companies need to take on board more of what you're talking about? More of that sense of giving people a sense of breather against this peer consumer pressure?
There's the perfect world then is the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because no matter what, behind all these business, there's employment, there's jobs, there's a huge amount around that. And I would never, ever want to be voice that stifles that. But at the same time, I think we need to raise general financial literacy. I think we need to raise general literacy on being a savvy shopper, but also managing our internet time really well. And I don't want to be one of those, no. Like, I'm very much pro industry and economics, absolutely. But I do think people need to be actively almost given permission to go, it's okay.
Or take permission on the part of themselves.
Exactly. And sometimes they need to hear it from somebody else. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have the thing. Because having access to these things is brilliant. And you can have anything you want, but we don't need everything in our lives. And to have the discipline to be able to step back. And it is a discipline because the world is noisy and the world is fast and the world is telling you to buy all these things. But to have the stoicism to step back and go, well, actually, do I really need this thing?
As you say, simply putting a bit of distance between you and the purchase. In a word, do you think this time next year we'll be talking about a growing Singles Day in Europe or in Ireland?
Absolutely.
Wow, that is a very strong word. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for joining me, money expert and author Kel Gallivan.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of the cruise ship. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. Now, for this week's trivia, I'm going to give you three clues as ever, and then we'll give you the answer at the end of the show. So here we go. Last Sunday, I did a 50-kilometre cycle in this place, and it is the largest enclosed urban park in Europe. That's the first clue. The second one is it has original gas street lamps from the 1800s. And here's the giveaway. The 10th President of Ireland, who was inaugurated this week, lives there. Where was I? And I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, as Irish holidaymakers look for new ways to explore the world, one sector of the travel industry has been quietly building up steam. Cruise holidays are seeing record interest, with more Irish travellers than ever choosing to take to the seas. And to get a sense of what's driving the surge and where the cruise market fits into the broader tourism picture, I'm joined by Paul Hackett, co-founder and CEO of Click & Go Holidays, and Vice President of the Irish Travel Agents Association. So, Paul, according to the CLIA UK and Ireland report, a total of 2.4 million cruises were taken by holidaymakers across the two countries in 2024. What's our culture of cruising here in Ireland, do you think?
I think we're probably slow to the market for cruising in terms of Ireland. The UK is very much ahead, and it would be in terms of population relative to Ireland. And then they are three times more likely to take a cruise than we are.
Three times?
Three times.
Why is that?
I think we have some preconceived ideas in the Irish psyche about what it is like to go on a cruise. I think if we actually put the cards on the table, I think some people feel they're going to get seasick. I think some people feel the ships are too big and there's just too many people and they're going to be stuck with the same people all the time. And I think then you go back to the old adage of cruises being for the newlyweds, the overfed and the nearly dead, which, as you know, being an avid cruiser, and as I know, is absolutely not the case.
Well, now, when we say that I'm an avid cruiser, I went on one 2 weeks ago with my mum and we sailed out of Baltimore, out of Maryland. And I will say I was none of the three categories of newlywed, overfed or nearly dead. But this whole point about seasickness, like that doesn't happen.
No, it's a nonsense. I think we haven't got to the point in the Irish market where enough people go on a cruise to convince everybody as to why they should. And when we look globally at the market, and when we look at the size of the market, and when we look at some statistics like the volume of repeat consumers, it is really, really telling. Like, globally, the repeat rate is 82%. In the UK, that increases to 92%.
So that means that for every 10 people that go on a cruise in the UK, 9 will go on another one.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, your experience or the listeners' experience who have taken a cruise will absolutely resonate with that in terms of the service, in terms of the value, in terms of the entertainment, in terms of just the difference, the convenience, all of the above are the reasons that we like cruise holidays. It's not that we're not going to take a land-based holiday again, but my God, it is absolutely my passion and my conviction to try and convince as many Irish people as possible to take a cruise, because if they do, they will be at those repeat rate levels. They will be at the 92%, I have no doubt.
Well, the one that I was on, Paul, had about 2,000 passengers, and I can't tell you how many crew. I mean, the idea of being stuck with the same people, sure, it was a blessing to bump into the same people at any stage along the way. But it's interesting what you say about the loyalty, because I was on the Royal Caribbean earnings call recently, mm-hmm. and they have a pithy line in there, which is that they say they want to turn the vacation of a lifetime to a lifetime of vacations. What is the stickability of cruising, do you think?
Huge. And I think that's down to the repeat. And I think Royal have we had them in our office only this week in terms of training and updating all of our staff on what they're doing. And they're most definitely moving away. And maybe this is the concept we need to think of, a bit like what they were saying in that earnings briefing, that it's not so much a cruise as a holiday. It's the vacation. It is the full, you know, holiday experience and everything you could wish for, but more.
Well, I do also want to talk as well, though, about the business model, because you pointed there about, you know, the food and the entertainment and everything else. Like, the business model, as I understand it, is the cruise ticket covers all the non-premium food, the accommodation. You wake up in a different place, obviously, because you're moving on a boat, and you've got the entertainment as well. But yet the price ticket can be pretty high for that, depending on where you go and so on. How does the value for money compare to a traditional land-based, as you say, holiday?
Yeah, I think, and we've done some work on this only this year in terms of looking at our forecasts and our numbers for next year. So on average, a consumer is going to pay, on average, between €150 to €200 per person per night for a cruise holiday. That's everything included, even the flights to get you to the destination. That's what the average is going to be. And the economics work for the cruise lines, and that's evident in terms of their numbers. Like, at the moment, or this year, there's about 35 million people taking cruise holidays. 5 years ago, that was 26 million. At present, there's 80 new ships on order with a delivery time of 2036. You can't actually get a slot in a shipyard globally to build a cruise ship until 2030. That's how committed these folks are. And you're looking at costs in the order of 800 million to 1 billion per ship. So they create a really strong value proposition. Like, if you take that 150 to 200 euros per person, that's your accommodation. That's all your food. And in terms of ours, it would be a mix of consumers who have purchased drinks packages and not purchased drinks packages. You compare that to a hotel in Ireland. Like, I'm off to Waterford the weekend after next. That's not even covering the room rate on a B&B, let alone anything else for the two of us. So the value proposition is really strong. These ships are sailing 12 months of the year. They're really efficient in terms of the sustainability and what they're doing in the marketplace. They are very affordable by virtue of the scale. Like, they are 2,000, 4,000, 5,000. You can get smaller ships, you can get larger ships. But from a business model perspective, the cruise lines are the dominant cruise lines, such as Royal, and Royal would be owning Royal Caribbean, Celebrity Cruises and Silver Sea. So they have three in the portfolio. Carnival have half a dozen in their portfolio. So these are large business models, mainly served out of the US, on the US stock market, like global businesses in terms of what they're doing.
And I remember looking at both Royal Caribbean and Carnival. I remember looking at their share prices in about August 2020. And Paul, the market had absolutely written cruising off completely. Like, that's only 5 years ago. You were referring back to earlier statistics there. How did the business model survive or adapt to COVID?
They lost billions. Like, the cruise lines lost billions. We had MSC in only 2 weeks ago, and they were talking about losing $2 billion for their cruise business during the pandemic, because what they had to do effectively was just put their ships out to sea, maintain a minimal crew and have no business. Like, if they're spending 1 billion per ship and they're writing it down over 20 years, on the capital cost alone, they have to generate X amount of income. Thankfully, these businesses are very well funded and none collapsed during the pandemic. So they were able to sustain those losses. They got back to sailing reasonably quickly, especially out of the US market. And again, if we look at cruise and we talk about the Irish market being slow, the US is a core market for the cruise business, be it Norwegian, Carnival, Royal Caribbean, all of those brands.
Also, like, as I said to you, we sailed out of Baltimore in Maryland. There was people who said that they lived three blocks away from the port.
I mean, the joy of it.
You know, they could walk to the terminal, you know. But I also want to ask about the ports, though, because
Fall to Ireland reported that each passenger contributes 80 euros of an increase in spending by guests, and each crew member brings 35 euro to the Irish economy. That could be for any, of course, mm-hmm. ship that arrives here. And Ireland's busiest port for cruises is Cove.
Yes.
Set to welcome 93 cruise ships with 160,000 passengers between April and November. Like, the ports that cruise ships go to, this is big business.
Huge business.
How does the cruise companies decide where they're going to go, and could Ireland be doing better?
Well, of course we could. It's down to scheduling, it's down to itinerary planning, and it's down to forward planning. And Dublin used to be a regular cruise port for all of the cruise lines, but Dublin Port is effectively closed to cruise passenger traffic unless the ship is, I think, less than 300 metres in length. They've gone very much after the commercial piece. So from a Dublin tourism point of view, that must be hitting the, you know, Dublin Chamber of Commerce, the shops, the restaurants and the bars in Dublin. Cove is absolutely doing splendidly well out of this, and it is also a breathtakingly beautiful port to sail into when you come in the mouth of Cork. It is gorgeous.
Now, Paul, you're dealing with a Cork woman here. Everywhere in Cork is breathtakingly beautiful. But what is it like at the moment? Labadee, the island off Haiti, is closed. I actually was there years ago. It was one of the most interesting places I've actually ever been. But what is it that leads to any of the companies deciding on new places? Like, what is it that people want? Do they want just sun? Do they want something different?
Oh, no. Very, very different. Like, you know, sun is part of it in terms of the Med or the Caribbean, but you also have Alaska, you have Iceland, you have the Norwegian fjords, you have Asia, Japan, all of the cruising in that destination. And then those repositioning cruises where the ships are moving from east to west, moving transatlantic. So it is not about pure sun. It is about an embarkation port that has access to a lot of air traffic. So Baltimore is a relatively small port in the States mm-hmm. for US traffic. The major ports are New York, then down to Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Port Canaveral. They are the core ports within the US. Within the Med, it's Barcelona, Rome and Athens. Used to be Venice, but Venice has pretty much reduced its capacity to manage ships for good reason. And that business has moved to Trieste or moved down the coast to Ravenna. And there's still a small number of ships sailing out of Venice. But it's itinerary driven. What interests the consumer? What's gonna motivate them to get back on the ship?
And then, of course, when you have the sea days, in our own case, because of, wasn't storm or Hurricane Melissa, but another storm that was at the port. We were due to be in Sydney in Nova Scotia, but we couldn't dock there because of weather. And of course, everything then is to be changed. The food and beverages has to be changed, and the entertainment and all that sort of thing has to be changed. So when it comes to the itinerary and the itinerary management, of course, they're also dealing with very much real-time weather.
Oh, very much. And I had the same experience last year. We were doing a transatlantic from Barcelona to New York. We were due to dock in Bermuda, and due to winds, they couldn't dock. So we had another sea day. For me, a sea day is a joy.
Oh, sure. I was doing everything. I was at the gym. I was doing trivia. I was doing all sorts. I had a great time. Can I ask you, though, you're talking about there the growing market in Ireland. Royal Caribbean mentioned that there's a $2 trillion vacation market. And naturally enough, they said that they want to get more of that. What do you think is the direction of travel for the global market in terms of cruising? Like, you know, because it's not just about, obviously, the US, it's about everywhere else as well. Is there more people cruising in the future, do you think?
Absolutely. Like, if you think in the last 5 years, they have added pretty much 10 million capacity annually to the cruise ship market. And when you think about the number of new ships that are being built by all of the cruise lines at various sizes, catering to different audiences, it's not all about the large ship. It can be about the smaller ship taking in the Antarctica or some, or, you know, one of those exploration cruises. So it is absolutely a growing market, and it's a growing market because there are markets like Ireland who are under-indexing in cruise. There's different markets in the Med, Central Europe the same, Asia coming into it. The US is heavily developed, the UK heavily developed, and the Australia market really heavily developed. But at those repeat rates that we're seeing, they will continue to grow. At the value for money proposition, more and more consumers are doing it every year and repeating every year. So the actual core business repeat market is growing. And then you have the new to cruise market coming in where people are taking a chance on it for the very first time. And when they take a chance, my goodness, they are rewarded and they will be back to cruise holidays.
I've one last question just about the trends, because in that earnings call, they mentioned that 50% of onboard revenue during the third quarter was booked pre-cruise. Like, the what of people, not just the new to market, but the repeat customers, are there any new trends that you're spotting with them?
Absolutely. The cruise lines are very much enhancing their app feasibility and functionality. So what they're pushing out to you as the holidaymaker in advance of travel in terms of the excursions that you might do in a particular destination, the onboard activities that you may have to pay extra for, but that they will do at a particular offer, the drinks package, if the drinks package isn't already included. So they are really adept. These are great commercial businesses. I'd love to understand more about when they get to that break-even point on a ship, because that's clearly, it's clearly very profitable for these companies to be investing at this level and forward planning at this level. But it's also really working for the consumer in terms of filling a demand for a holiday option that is second to none.
Well, what I do think that they're very good for is when you have people with different interests. As you can imagine, Paul, yeah. I talked to practically the 2,000 people while I was there, and my mum said, this is great, I don't have to talk as much. So, yeah. Really appreciate you taking the time to come in and talk to us today. This is Paul Hackett, co-founder and CEO of Click and Go Holidays and Vice President, Travel Agents Association.
Thanks, Susan.
Up next, should the crisis hit BBC change its funding model? Now, it hasn't been a good week for the BBC. What was once seen as the gold standard in journalism is now embroiled in a spat with President Trump, which has led him to threaten to sue the corporation for $1 billion. However, this is not an isolated incident, as there have been criticisms of BBC Current Affairs coverage on a number of contentious subjects. Now, joining me to delve right into the strategic heart of the BBC is Stephen Barnett, a professor of communications at the University of Westminster. So, Stephen, President Trump has taken on legal challenges before against CBS and ABC, and they settled with him. But he hasn't won against CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. Can you take us through what this particular one with the BBC is all about?
Yes. Well, in terms of Trump's spat with the BBC, this is about a Panorama documentary that was actually aired a week before the presidential election last October. And it only came to light fairly recently that there was that documentary, by the way, as part of the BBC's Panorama strand, was made by an independent company. It only came to light quite recently that within that Panorama, the famous speech that, or I should say infamous speech that Trump made on Capitol Hill, where he was telling his supporters to go and march on the Capitol, where, and he did use the word peacefully, it should be stressed, but he interspersed that with various quite aggressive terms about how he expected people to fight. It was a 75-minute speech, and that Panorama had spliced together two separate bits of it, which made it look as if, or at least it is alleged that it made it look as if it was more aggressive and more insightful than it actually was. Now, we can argue about what the material effect of that splicing was. But the fact is, if you just look at it in editorial journalistic terms, it is undeniable. And this is the BBC's problem, that two separate bits were spliced together and that was not made clear to the audience.
Okay.
It's not unusual, as you'll know, in TV and radio production to splice together two different bits, but normally what you would do is you would make it clear to the audience that these were two different bits of the speech, and they didn't do that.
But what I do want to ask you about as well, Stephen, because I'm not splitting hairs on this, but it is important that, as you mentioned, Panorama was shown in October 2024. But Trump can't sue in the UK, as cases must be brought within 12 months of libel. And so since obviously it's past the 12 months, instead he's bringing the case in Florida because the deadline is 2 years. However, yeah, the BBC iPlayer isn't accessible in the US and therefore in Florida. So how does that affect literally the geography in which the case is being taken?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's not splitting hairs at all. And, you know, the fact is that for people to have actually viewed it in America, arguably, they would have had to use a VPN, which is against the law. So they would have been breaching copyright law. So it's difficult to see. My understanding is that until the story broke, it had only been viewed something like 80 times in the States. So it's difficult to see how a case can really be made for defamation, which involves a serious impact on someone's reputation. There's another issue, of course, as to whether you could argue that this has seriously impacted on Trump's reputation at all. And I think there are a number of issues here. I mean, you're right to pick up the geography of it, and it is not splitting hairs at all. It's really quite important.
Well, it is. And also, Trump says that it has not just been reputational, but financially imperative. Well, that there has been both financial and reputational damages, and thus to the tune of $1 billion. Like, it's not an insignificant amount of money.
Let's be clear about what Donald Trump's tactics have been. And you mentioned the suits that he's actually launched against various publishers. Some of them have settled because they would rather settle than take it to court. Those that haven't settled, he's lost. So the question is this a serious attempt with a serious legal basis to it, or is it intimidation? And certainly all the legal commentary that I have read, that I have looked at, without exception, have said there is no case to answer. He would lose in an American court of law because, unlike the UK, there's a very high bar for people, for public figures, where you have to demonstrate actual malice in a libel case, in a defamation case. So even before you get to the point of how many people watched and whether there was real damage to reputation, it is very unlikely that he would get anywhere near that bar. So the real question is this an attempt to intimidate? And if the BBC resists, which we can talk about if you want, but in my own personal opinion is they must resist, what happens then in terms of whether Trump decides to take it to court and the BBC is forced to stump up legal fees? I think that's a really difficult issue for the BBC.
Now, this is the thing, though, is that it also is an issue for the paying public who is paying their licence fees. So if we take a look at the funding model of the BBC, in the last annual report, it took in £5.9 billion. 65% of that came from the TV licence fee. 88% of households who are legally obliged to have one does so. And it costs round about $166 million to collect that money. So when you take that into consideration, the optics don't look great. When you get easy media headlines around, say, the $1 billion or a thing like that, do you think this could influence that percentage of people who are paying the licence fee or even the sentiment around it?
I'm not sure it will, to be honest. I mean, I think there is, even amongst those, and the BBC has quite a few enemies, it has to be said, not least those who have been talking up this particular episode. I mean, I didn't challenge any of your intro, but it has to be said that these things have come to light because those who really don't particularly like the BBC wanted to make sure they came to light. So there's a whole issue there about the extent to which this is a really serious breach. But anyway, put that to one side. I think there is actually quite a lot of support for the BBC standing up for the truth, accuracy, integrity, which what most people understand it does stand for. Everybody understands that organizations, news organizations, make mistakes. Except for those news organizations that hate the BBC for different reasons, but they don't have a great track record. So I think my own sense of it is that people know that Trump is a bully and they don't like bullies, particularly bullies from other countries. So if the BBC says, we will absolutely stand by the essence of what we were saying, we will absolutely apologize for making that editorial cut and not making it obvious, we will apologize unreservedly for that, but we will not pay any money. I think people could live with that because there is an understanding, there's a tolerance of mistakes made which are acknowledged transparently and then apologized for.
Right. Now, if we go back to something you said about halfway through the answer there, though, your point is about people want that truth, they want that impartiality, etc. So leaving the Trump case aside, the actual edit within the video or any of the other issues that has come to, well, not come to light over the last few weeks, but the issues that are there just about that impartiality of reporting. Is that, do you think, a storm in a teacup? Or is that something, like, at the end of the day, we have had two very senior people resign as well, Stephen?
Yes. And if you want my answer to whether it's a storm in a teacup, my answer is absolutely yes. And I think the resignations are not because there was a mistake made. The resignations are quite clearly because the news team said a week ago on Monday, we're talking 10 days ago now, we want to make an immediate apology. We want to acknowledge this and put out an apology. They were prevented from doing so by certain people on the BBC board, led, it is alleged, and this has been well reported, by Sir Robbie Gibb, who was appointed by Boris Johnson and calls himself a Thatcherite Tory. They prevented the management from doing what they wanted to do, which was to make an immediate apology, and said, we're going to wait until we can write a letter to the Commons Select, the chair of the Commons Select Committee. In that vacuum, that 4 or 5 days of waiting, drafting the letter, sending it backwards and forwards to try and get agreement, that's when this blew up. And that means that the BBC lost control. They lost the opportunity to make an immediate, a swift, unqualified apology for an editorial mistake, and the whole thing blew up.
Okay.
So I'm afraid the short answer to your question is, yes, it is a storm in a teacup, but it does put the spotlight firmly on political appointments on the board of the BBC.
Yes, and that's where I want to go next. Because if we look at that, when the BBC charter was renewed in 2016, the Tory government, a Conservative government, determined that the BBC would be governed by a unitary board of 14, including a chair, 4 part-time members, each representing one of the UK's nations. And these 5 were all government appointees. So there is heavy political influence. In fact, some people might state that heavy is too light, ironically, a word. Now, what changes do you see on the horizon? Not necessarily that you might want to see, but that you see realistically on the horizon for the next BBC charter starting from January 2028?
Well, they're changes that I want to see, and I think may well be coming. Because I watched the debate in Parliament on Tuesday. Lisa Nandy, the Secretary of State, made it quite clear that they are looking at some of these areas. There were several calls from MPs who stood up and named Robbie Gibb, suggesting that he should resign. So I think the pressure now is on to find some kind of solution that eliminates those partisan political appointments that you've just talked about, those 5 political appointments. It hasn't really been an issue until now, although behind the scenes, BBC journalists have been saying for some time there's been a fairly malign influence. It's now out in the open, which I think is a good thing. So what I would want to see is a wholly different appointments process whereby an independent board is established, and that board then appoints non-partisan, non-political, non-executives. I think it's important to have non-executives who will help to keep an eye on what's going on. It's important that there is scrutiny. The BBC must be held accountable, but it must be done in a non-partisan way, not by people who have axes to grind.
And that is from a perspective of governance. If we move back to the moment for the perspective of financing, you quoted Lisa Nandy there, and I want to go back to something she said in January 2025. She has ruled out BBC funding from general taxation and instead said she was thinking quite radically and creatively. Have we any insight into what that might mean? Or do you think that, again, might be in any way influenced over what happened over the past week?
I don't think it will, actually, funnily enough. I mean, I think that you're right that there is a whole debate about funding. The idea of a TV license fee is clearly becoming quite anachronistic. It feels almost quaint. But the idea of households or individuals paying towards an institution which then belongs to all of us, it's not owned by an American tech company or a corporate streamer or anything like that. It's ours. It belongs to us. It is publicly funded and held accountable by our elected representatives. I think that's quite appealing. So my own sense of it is that there will probably be changes to make it more progressive, because at the moment it's a regressive tax. There's a lot made of the fact that, you know, the aristocrat in the castle pays the same as the humble unemployed person. But I do think there are ways of ameliorating that. But I think the idea of a single fee paid by households or individuals is one that might actually survive under a different name.
Okay, and that certainly will be one to watch, I think, in the coming weeks, but or years. I do want to ask you one thing, though, particularly about the BBC Director General, Tim Davey, who did resign this week, because the DG of the BBC is simultaneously required to be chief executive of a company employing 21,000 people, Stephen, and editor-in-chief of all content across the platform that reaches 453 million people weekly, including three quarters of Brits. Is it reasonable that one person should do all of that job?
It's a hell of a job. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I've met Tim a few times, and there's no question it is completely exhausting and draining. And the energy that he brought to the job was actually pretty amazing. I just hope he doesn't put people off. I mean, I think what you're suggesting or you're intimating is that maybe there should be a division of roles.
Yes, that's what I'm intimating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe we should think about the idea of the editorial role, the overall editorial role being given to perhaps, you know, the director of news and current affairs, and maybe make them the overall editor of the BBC's output and leave the DG to operate on all the other levels. I mean, there is a chief operating officer. So there is someone who looks after the kind of, you know, the strategic approach of the institution. But it's become, particularly in such a polarized world where opinions are so easily divided, I think it has become a job that we need to look at ways in which it's made easier for the person who is at the helm, who's leading it off.
Well, I was looking at the list of candidates who are being considered for the job, and I'll tell you this much, they're going to need some CV, of which many, many, many of them do. But it will be interesting just to see, I think, how the job evolves, how the organisation evolves, and of course, that political influence as well. It was really super to talk to you and to get the local perspective as well. Thank you so much indeed. Stephen Barnett, Professor of Communications at the University of Westminster.
Pleasure. Thank you very much, Susan.
Now, for the answer to my trivia question, last Sunday, I did a 50-kilometre cycle in this place, which is the largest enclosed urban park in Europe. It has original gas street lamps from the 1800s, and this is a giveaway clue. The 10th President of Ireland, who was inaugurated this week, lives there. Where did I do said cycle? It is, of course, the Phoenix Park in Dublin. That's where I was. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And if you do listen to us on podcasts, please do pop it into any WhatsApp groups that you think might be interested in listening to us. And of course, Taking Stock is also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of the show is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Kate Henshaw. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound, and thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy the rest of your day, and I'm already looking forward to chatting to you again next week.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping.
It's just so beautiful. Oh yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.